pleasure to talk here. So I'll talk about something which we call string axioms. It's based on the work, the paper which is going to appear somewhere around next week with Mina Arvanitaki, Saus Dimopoulos, Nemanja Kalper, and John McPherson. So the main point of this talk is that this thing actually can be observed. But let me first explain what we mean by this, by axioms. And I'll start with the same formula that Ben wrote yesterday, namely, there is a term which can be added to QCD Lagrangian, which has this form. And the most interesting thing about this term is that we know that this coefficient is tiny. To be more precise, so what is really bounded is what's called theta bar, which is theta plus the overall phase of the quark matrix, quark mass matrix. And this thing bounded to be less than something 10 to minus 9. And this problem, it's kind of similar to other more famous fine-tuning problems as electric hierarchy and cosmological constant. Also, here we're dealing with different quantities, apparently from related physical origins, which should be, which fine-tuned to give, in the sum, give something which is really small. But there is important difference about this problem as compared to its more famous cousins. Namely, I think we have very good reason to think that there is nothing anthropic about this fine-tuning. In other words, this is clear indication for some new dynamics which should explain why this number is small. And we're not that certain in two other cases. And as Ben was saying yesterday, there is a nice solution to this problem, namely what one should do. One should it's theta parameter to the scalar field axiom. And then QCD instantons will generate potential for the axiom, which will minimize at the point where the observed theta bar is zero. So it's very nice solution, and it works at the field theory level. But formulated this way, it's not obvious at all how natural such a thing to get in microscopic theory. So you need something funny to happen here. You need some kind of symmetry which gets spontaneously broken. So this, at the classical level, this axion is a Goldstone boson of that symmetry. But on the other hand, it's not really symmetry because it's broken by QCD. And by the way, all other contributions to the axion potential, if there are any, so they should be at least 10 order of magnitude, or 9 order of magnitude down below that scale. Otherwise, this solution doesn't work. And again, this fact requires some dynamical explanation, because there's no reason for fine-tuning here. And this is especially, maybe especially suspicious about this, given the standard law that usually global symmetries are broken in quantum gravity. So it seems interesting to look what happens in microscopic theory involving gravity in such a situation. And so let's see what happens in string theory. Are there natural axioms in string theory? And in fact, there are. And the reason for that is the following. So in string theory, typically there are many antisymmetric tensor forms, like there is Navier-Schwarz B2 form, which presents all string theories. Now, then there are in type 2B, there are Ramon-Ramon forms in Pompeii also. There are some. Now, what happens now, when you do KK reduction, an interesting property of high-order forms is compared to just scalar zero form, is that upon KK reduction, you typically get many zero KK modes of these forms, which acts, the form that has some indices. Now, if I put two of these indices, I put all these indices along compact, along extra dimensions, that gives me scalar particle, pseudo-scalar particle in four-dimensional effective theory. And so zero mode, if there are any zero modes for these particles, they would be a massless scalar field in my theory. Now, the interesting property that typically there are many of them, and this has simple topological reason. So the zero modes, so we have some complicated six-dimensional manifold, and so typically there are many non-trivial handles in this manifold. Like, for instance, if you take the simplest example, like six torus, there will be, for six torus, it's just simple combinatorics. There are many ways to non-trivially embed, say, two cycle in six-dimensional manifold. For six torus, one gets 15 two cycles and 15 four cycles to start with. And the point is that zero modes of this field, they're labeled by this cycle. So whenever you have a non-trivial cycle in your manifold, you get zero mode for antisymmetric tensor field. Of course, six torus is a by far too simplistic example. So typical complexifications give rise to something like standard model. So there are typically hundreds of these cycles, so maybe even 10, up to 10 to 5. So these are potential candidates for something which would be QCD axion. And moreover, they also have right couplings because, so first of all, because of the 10 dimensional, this antisymmetric fields, they are gauge fields in 10 dimensional series. So there is gauge symmetry associated to that. So they're protected. They're not only massless, they really don't have any potential at the perturbative level. But then they have Chern-Simons couplings, which are, again, they're dictated by gauge invariance, by Green-Schwarz mechanism for anomaly cancellations. And these kind of couplings, they give rise to these axionic couplings in the four-dimensional theory. So these are natural candidates for the axion, it's not at all, I think it's not fair to say that axion is predicted by string theory, because there are many ways how these fields could be not there. For instance, one can turn on fluxes, which would make these things heavy. Also, one can wrap brains, which would lift some of them. Even if that doesn't happen at the perturbative level, there are many sources of potential for these guys. From, again, either it could be some gauge sector. So if you have a handle, and for instance, if you have two cycles, you take D5 brain and wrap it around that cycle, then it low energy theory that would correspond to having an extra gauge sector, which is coupled to this axion in the same way, and it could give rise to the potential which is too big to spoil the solution of strong CP problem. And even if there are no such gauge sectors, there are virtual contributions coming from brains, virtual brains wrapping these cycles, string instantons. And again, they can easily give corrections to the axion potentials, which are by far too large to allow a solution of strong CP problem. So I think the way to look at it is not that axion is predicted by string theory, but rather that it can come out of string theory construction as a requirement, so indication that strong CP problem is solved dynamically should be considered as a limitation of the model building, string theory model building. So dynamics should prefer a complexification such that QCD axion is there. Now, if you buy this argument, then again, given that there was no anthropic reason for this to be small, and given that potentially complexification had hundreds of these axions, it would be really bizarre if at the end of the day it turns out that there is just one QCD axion with all contributions to its potential small. You would expect that there will be at least few of them, or maybe many. Again, because there is no... It shouldn't be an exception in the manifold, in the computation manifold we're considering. So from this picture, we come to conclusion that it's kind of natural. So if you combine strong CP problem and the way axions come out in string theory, it's actually natural to expect many axions, and which can be much lighter than QCD, because only one, so if there are many axions, there will be one linear combination which is coupled to GGDUAL. But for the others, at least for some of them, you expect that all these instanton corrections to their potential are much smaller than that's coming from QCD, okay, because that should be dynamics. So we expect to have many ultralight axions, and that's what we call axiverse. So
are you saying you expect to have many ultralight axions which couple primarily to which get their potential primarily from QCD?
No, the point is that if you have many axions, there is one linear combination of all of them which couples to QCD GGDUAL.
Yes.
That linear combination gets mass from the QCD. All other linear combinations don't get that mass.
Presumably, there's a bunch of other stuff that axioms
can. Yeah, so they could get other contributions to their potential. But again, we know that for this one particular linear combination, all these other contributions are small. And we don't think that this is fine-tuning, so that's good reason to think that probably there are other contributions for which this contribution is also small, but they don't get mass from QCD, so they will be much lighter scalar field in your theory. And there could be really many of them, so there could be hundreds of them, because potentially there is room really for a huge number of these particles.
You were saying that the fluxes tend to lift the axions. If I take something like, I don't know, KKLT, are there axions?
Okay, that's a very good point. So as I said, so existence of QCD axion, just of QCD axion, as I said, it should be considered as a limitation on string theory model building. For instance, if you, as in KKLT, you compact define on your moduli in supersymmetric way. So axion usually comes out in a supermultiple that way. Its scalar component is just usual moduli. And it gets, if it's stabilized in supersymmetric way, that means in such compactification, axion will get lifted because it's super partner of a heavy guy. So just, this is an indication that actually you should look for compactifications where the sum of the moduli are not stabilized in supersymmetric way. That just follows from if you want to have QCD axion and don't want to be the result of fine-tuning. So it disfavors KKLT type situation. And actually, so that brings back what's called cosmological moduli problem. So it tells that some of the moduli, they're not stabilized in supersymmetric way, some of the scalar moduli. So that means that they would get mass of the TV scale or from Susie breaking. So the way we deal with that, so one way maybe to say that Susie is broken the high scale and it's much heavier. So the way we did with it, we said, okay, let's assume that Hubble Urine Fashion was low. So something like, say, to be safe, less than 0.1 GV. That corresponds, if reheating is efficient enough, that would correspond to reheating temperature for the 10 to 7 GV, so it's still high enough to have successful baryogenesis and normal cosmology. So maybe there are other ways out of it, but just we're being lazy. That's the safest way to solve it.
So you're saying why you need a lower energy replacement?
Because, so there are these other scalar partners of axions, which get GV scale masses. And so if inflation scale is higher than their mass, then they are frozen during inflation, but later on they will start oscillating. And some of them can overclose the universe, and you can say, okay, these are anthropically excluded. But also some of them typically, they have dimension, so they have decays mediated by Planck suppressed operators. So many of them won't overclose the universe, but they will decay, say, during BBN or after BBN distorts the CMB spectrum. So they just exclude observationally. So you cannot...
That GV scale comes from...
This is gravity-mediated Susie breaking. So we're assuming low-energy Susie for that. Yeah, you can relax this if, so for instance, Susie is broken at high scale. Because one unpleasant thing, which will be compensated later during the talk, but one thing which one may find unpleasant by this is that there is no B-mode signal with such a low scale. But
first of all, I mean, the nature of whatever it is.
But actually,
that's something. I saw sometimes people like Bimol Sigmo, people say that axions also like axions. But actually, there is a conflict between the two, even independently of this argument, because as Ben was saying yesterday, I'll come to that later. But there are good things. There are good reasons to think that maybe QCD axion, just theoretically, the scale something like 10 around God scale, grand unification scale. Or actually, this argument would apply always when scale of inflation is below PQ phase transition scale. So if that happened, then just from the limit on either curvature perturbations which QCD axion would generate, telling you that inflation scale should be low enough, not that low, but something like 10 to 9 GeV, such that there is no hope for B-mode signal. So there is definitely a conflict between having a polarization signal from gravity waves and between QCD axion. But just to be safe, so we assume that inflationary scale is low. It's not crazy, I think. Just to give another example that really the requirement to have QCD axion really imposes strong restrictions on model building. For instance, in weakly coupled heterotic theory, there are always string instantons which give too large contributions to spoil the strong CP solution problem. So it's QCD axion is not a prediction of string theory. It's really a restriction on the models. So in the rest of the talk, I will discuss how we can confirm this picture, how this whole thing can be observed. There are two crucial parameters which determine all the phenomenology of these guys. So there is the periodicity of the axion, this FA scale, which controls the coupling. And the mass, now for the QCD axion, there is a simple relation between the two. So the axion mass is something like 6 10 to minus 6 electron volt, 10 to 16 GeV over FA. But for other axions, there is no this relation. In principle, these are two unrelated parameters. But what turns out in many concrete examples, it's convenient to parameterize it in a bit different way. So the axion Lagrangian, it has this form. So there is kinetic term and potential, which is a function of A over FA. Now this lambda, it could be either, the same is either some dynamical scale of some gauge sector, or it's generated by some non-perturbative instanton effects. In both cases, you can write it as some UV scale mu to the 4 times e to minus s, where e to minus s is y is 1 over alpha, or it's the action of the instanton which generates this thing. So it's actually more convenient to talk in terms of this s parameter m. And in many concrete examples, what comes out is that there is a relation. There is a relation between these parameters of the following form, that FA comes out of order M Planck over S. And this has a simple geometrical origin, actually. Understand how it comes out. Namely, if you do quantification, if you're calculating your Planck mass, then four-dimensional Planck mass is proportional to L to the 6, where L is the size of the quantification manifold. And there are some powers 1 over GS squared, L is to the 8. This is the Planck mass. Now, if you look at the FA, on the other hand, this is coefficient. So we have this anti-symmetric tensor form. We have its kinetic form. kinetic term, and there are two powers, because it's a tensor field in high-dimensional series, there is two powers of inverse metric in front of this kinetic term. So when you calculate FA, you find that it's given by the same, there is the same L plus 6, LS minus 4, but also there is inverse square of the area of the cycle which where this axion is coming from, of the circle which this antisymmetric, the indices antisymmetric form goes through, just from these two powers of inverse metric here. And if your manifold is not more or less is isotropic and there is no large warping, then this gives this is 1 over L to the 4. So if A squared scales like L squared, and then if you plug here, so there is this relation, but on the other hand, so for instance, in case when the axion potential is generated by string instanton, the action of this instanton is just proportional, again, it's proportional to the area of this cycle, because geometrically this instanton is just brain wrapped around this cycle, so the action is proportional to the area of the cycle times, again, appropriate power of Gs and Ls. And then what you find, when you take this into account, you find that this relation. Now, of course, it can be, there are squildes here, and you can take warp situation, or you can consider some anisotropic manifold, so you can make FA way smaller than that. But actually, in explicit examples, it never comes out larger than this ratio, and there is this weak gravity conjecture by Alberta and friends, which says actually that this property is just, it follows from very basic features as of quantum black hole physics. So there is an upper bound of FA given M Planck over S, because S here is effectively the gauge coupling for this form field. Now, in our context, again, in order to have successful solution of the strong CP problem, from the requirement that all contributions to the axion potential at the level 10 to minus 10 of the from QCD, that means that S should be of order 200. So that it means that FAs, they naturally come out around gut scale. So in what we are doing, the picture we assumed, which maybe just, so it's not very well, it doesn't need to be really there, so one may consider more general framework. But for this paper, we assumed the following distribution of the axion parameters. So we assume that there is no strong warping, or the manifold is not very anisotropic. So we assume that a phase of all axions, they are somewhere around gut scale. On the other hand, axion masses, they are exponentially sensitive to the area of the cycles. So even if FA is order 1 distributed around gut scale, you expect axion masses to be homogeneously or quasi-homogeneously distributed on the log of the log of energy scales. So that's our picture for what we call axiverse. FA is roughly at the same scale. Maybe, they can vary within a few factors, but masses distributed quasi-homogeneously on the log scale. Okay, let me now draw the line. Axion masses. And let me start discussing what are the signatures. So this would be axion mass in electron volts. So let me start now discussing what one can call the map of the axiverse. So what would be the way to look for this axion? So let me start with the lightest ones. So let me start with axions with masses, say, between those which are lighter than Hubble. They're not very interesting, so they're frozen now. You don't really see them. But let me start by discussing axions with masses between Hubble and roughly Hubble now and Hubble at recombination, or maybe matter radiation equality, which is not that different. So for these axions, actually to be able to observe them, so this is a model dependent part. So if they are purely gravitationally coupled, yeah, I don't think there is a way you can observe these guys. But so as I was writing before, so axions have coupling to QCD, but just as they have coupling to QCD, they can also have coupling to an M. They can be coupled to photon in the same way. So this coupling usually comes out, so it's always one loop suppressed, so there is always alpha over pi over FA, and then photon FF dual, and C is coefficient of order one. So they may have, these axions may have this coupling, they may not have this coupling. It's model dependent, and for instance, if you think in terms of four-dimensional Grand Unified Theory, that light axions would never have these couplings, because in four-dimensional Grand Unified Theory, the same linear combination which couples to QCD FF dual, it's the same linear combination which couples to U1 FF dual, because it comes from the coupling overall SU5, and that means that it gets mass from the QCD instanton. So light axions, in this case, they don't have this coupling. On the other hand, in the context of high-dimensional unified theory of orbifold gas, which are not really, the Lagrangian of that series is not really SU5 invariants. It's SU5 invariants in the bulk, but it can be broken explicitly by some singularities. So in that context, it's quite natural to have different linear combinations coupled to SU3, SU2, and U1 parts. And then couplings come out to be that order of magnitude. Now, what does this coupling do for you? It does the following. So what is the fate of this axion as the universe expands? So if its mass in this range, then at the recombination, it's still frozen. So it has potential, more or less typically something, some periodic potential, cosine, so with field range for the 2 pi FA here. So it's frozen somewhere here. But later on, when Hubble drops below the mass, it starts oscillating and goes to zero. Yeah? I'll come back to that. But so the short answer, not for these masses. So first of all, I'm not worried about that due to reason Ben was talking about. Actually, that's what makes interesting looking for QCD axion. That's something I should have said. That's what makes interesting to look for QCD axion with FA of order 10 to 16. Because you find such a particle, that's a very clean signal that we live not in axiverse, we live in a multiverse. That there is, at least dark matter is selected anthropically. But yeah, I'm not worried about it. I'm more excited about that. But there is no this issue for these guys. These guys are too light. So for their typical displacement angles, they contribute something like 10 to minus 5 of dark matter density here. So these guys are not anthropic. Now, what happens in such a situation? So also, because inflation scale is low, this axion field is really almost homogeneous. So the inhomogeneities in the axion field is negligible. In this scenario. So what we predict, so what happens then, so when CMB photon travels to us from large scattering surface, then, so when axion is constant, this is just pure derivative. This term doesn't affect in an equation. But when it changes in time, it results in rotation of polarization plane for CMB photon. And in this case, so the rotation angle, it's just proportional, so it's proportional to this coefficient, C alpha 4 pi over FA, times the change of the axion field along the line of sight, which is, in our case, 2 pi FA. So you predict here, you predict the rotation of polarization angle for CMB, which is of order coefficients order 1 times basically fine structure constant. And so the remarkable feature of this result is that actually it's independent of axion scale, of the FA, and also it's independent of inflationary scale. So it's really it's given by alpha and order one coefficient, and also it's uniform throughout the sky, so it's a very specific pattern. Now what it does for you, it does the following. So if you have you have E-mode of polarization created by scalars. Now, because of this rotation, you create, so this part of E-mode gets converted to B-mode. But also, this B-mode is very different from inflationary B-mode because, so this scalar wave, it spontaneously breaks parity. So not only you create B-mode, but also you create B and TB cross-correlation. So that signal is very different from the B-mode signal, which you would see from inflation, where it actually, my understanding is that current bound on this rotation angle, they come predominantly from looking at for this quantity, not for B-mode, just because T, for instance, is much, much bigger than B. So the current bound from W-map on this rotation angle is around 2 degrees, which is order of magnitude higher than this value. But Planck will improve it by an order of magnitude, and CMB Paul potentially may improve it by more than two orders of magnitude. And also, yeah, of course, obvious point, so if there are many of these axions, you will get enhancement here, which scales like square root of n. Okay, so that's what happens for these light guys. Now, let me... I'll turn to high masses. So roughly I will be discussing now axions with mass range from 10 to minus 28 electron volt up to 10 to 18 electron volt. It will be clear later the reason for that scale. And so first of all, in this mass range, there is interesting value of the mass, which is somewhere around 10 to minus 20, 10 to minus 21. It depends on the value of your FA, which you assume. Where, so these axions, they're not anthropic. So their abundance is smaller than dark matter abundance. But these axions become anthropic. For the typical misalignment level angle, they would overclose the universe. Again, I'm not worried by that. So they could be there and just have small misalignment angle. So how would you see these guys? So to see them, you actually don't need, so this is more model independent. You don't need any direct coupling to matter. So what happens is the following. So if there is fraction of dark matter made of these ultralight scalar fields, then there is a characteristic scale, basically, following from uncertainty principle. If you have light scalar field, then there is a scale in the expanding universe. There is scale of order square root of mh, such that at distances longer than scale, this scalar field behaves in the same way as usual cold dark matter. Of course, I mean, these axions, they're all non-relativistic, so the way it goes, just as it was before. So frozen in, then at some moment they start oscillating. Usual axion story. Now, a distance is longer than square root of mh, the perturbations in axions, they grow in the same way as for dark matter. But at scales smaller than that, uncertainty principle, because these are not particles, these are really waves, so the uncertainty principle prevents perturbation from growth. They cannot cluster at scales shorter than the Dayburg wavelengths. So perturbation in this axion component doesn't grow. In other words, what these guys would make for you, so if you look at the dark matter power spectrum, then there would be a step-like feature in the power spectrum at the scale corresponding to the moment when axion starts oscillating in the early universe. yeah, so let me write what the scale is. So it's 10 to minus 2 inverse megaparsec m four times 10 to 88 one half. So this mass corresponds to axion which starts oscillating at matter radiation equality. If there is a component of dark matter made of these axions, you expect to see a step-like feature in the dark matter power spectrum, which is very similar to the feature which you see if there are free-streaming neutrinos. It's bosonic version of the same effect. Now, the size of the step is proportional to the abundance of this axion, relative abundance of these axions in dark matter. So by measuring this step, you not only, you first of all measuring the mass, but also you're measuring the relative abundance of these axions.
Why is the scale the square root of mh? Is that easy to explain?
Yeah, it is easy to explain. So, okay, very good. It is easy to explain. So, okay, if you look at the scale, so you look in the expanding universe at the perturbation of the size L. So, roughly, this perturbation, you can say that because of Hubble flow, they have velocity of order h times L. On the other hand, due to uncertainty principle, so you know that momentum of this perturbation, which is mv times L, should be less than 1. Oh, sorry, larger than 1. Which means that mh times L squared should be always larger than 1. So for L, for which this doesn't is not satisfied, there is no growth. It's really uncertainty principle.
I beg to differ.
Huh?
I don't think it's the uncertainty principle.
Well, it depends on the language we're using. It's you see it there in the classical field language. You can say it's classical,
yep.
Right? So you see the classical field theory, but on the other hand, if you think in terms of particles,
there's no H bar in the problem.
Well, again, it depends on, you can talk in terms of scale. So H bar appeared the moment you converted from particles to fields. So it's classical effect in in the field language, but in quantum, in particle quantum mechanics language, it's really uncertainty principle.
Yeah, I have a pet peeve against this because the formulas were written.
No, but so for instance, it's the same argument whether laser is quantum or classical phenomenon.
Yes.
In one language, it's quantum because, okay, it's due to Bayes statistics. But all what this Bayes statistics does for you, it allows you to describe these particles as a classical field.
Okay.
So I think it's yeah, because then that's what quantum mechanics does for you. It converts particles into fields. And in that sense, it's quantum effect. But I think it's... Yeah, I definitely agree with you that you can all see this by just doing classical calculation. Yeah, absolutely. So this effect is easy to understand. Now, what is its size? What is the size of this effect? This omega A, the ratio omega A over omega M, it's also... How much time do I have? When did this time?
You've been going for about 40 minutes.
Okay.
So you got another 20 minutes.
Okay.
Can I have another question?
Yeah, sure.
So the usual relation between the mass and the potential is different in your model. Is that right?
Well, okay.
So the potential, let me ask you a question again. You approximate the potential quadratic here, but then there are going to be quartic corrections.
Yeah, actually, that's very important, actually. Yeah, so there is uncertainty in calculating this ratio because, this is cosine potential. And so, for instance, if you assume flat distribution for initial misalignment angle, so the This ratio will depend on where you sit, whether you sit here or sit close to the top. It will appear in the formula which I will write right now. So the answer for this Rayleigh abundance is the following. So it's given by the ratio FA squared over 3 and Planck squared. So it's just you write down this potential, you know the moment when axion becomes oscillating, and you calculate the density at that time. So it's this ratio, then times the redshift of the moment when axion starts oscillating over redshift of matter radiation equality. Let me explain how it comes out. So we have potential. We have potential of the following form. So it's m squared, f squared, say cosine a over fa. So axion start oscillating when h squared is of order m squared. And its energy density at that time is of order m squared over f squared. And m squared times f squared modulo this point that there is some uncertainty on where it's located. So it's, it should may be important. I'll come back to that. But on the other hand, h squared is just 3 m Planck times total energy density at that time, which means that at the moment when axion starts oscillating, its abundance with respect to the total energy density is just given by f squared over 3 m Planck squared. But the size of the step is determined by the ratio of the relative abundance of axion in dark matter. We don't care about photons for this quantity. That's where this enhancement factor comes in. So the earlier the axion starts oscillating, the larger its relative abundance with respect to cold dark matter, just because cold dark matter is subdominant component at that time. So there is this thing, and then there is the uncertainty, so some probability factor coming from probability distribution for different axion initial values. And for cosine potential, so this probability distribution, it has this form. So it's order one here, but so for instance, with probability, assuming flat distribution for initial axion values, with probability 0.2, you can get enhancement factor here 10, and with probability 0.1, you can get enhancement factor here, which is 20. So this effect that axion initially can sit closer to its maximum, and that way the relative abundance of axions get enhanced, it can be quite significant, especially you think of having, say, tens of axions. So then for some of them, this effect will be enhanced. Now, actually, the size of the step is not just this. There is extra enhancement. So there is extra factor of order 8. So it's coming from the fact that basically this effect, this step, if you look at the, if you're doing observation at late redshifts, that there is integrated effect, because what the presence of this component does is that the dark matter doesn't grow linearly with A, it grows with linearly power, and so there is long integration time basically from matter radiation equality till Z, say order 1, if we're talking about observations. Now, so there is extra enhancement of order 8 which could be there if you're doing late time observation. So that what really. So this would be the estimate for the size of this feature. Now, how one could see it? So for CMB, it's kind of hopeless, because at CMB scales, this redshift ratio is for the 1, and for
because of this weak gravity thing. So the FA squared over 3 M Planck squared, this ratio is 4 to 10 to minus 5, or maybe 10 to minus 4, but not much bigger than that. So at CMB scales, we don't expect to get more than 1,000 from here. So it's hopeless. On the other hand, also there are limits on this kind of features from Lyman alpha, but again, the precision is not enough. On the other hand, for instance, there is this, for galaxy surveys, like there is this BOSS, which is a part of SDSS. So they claim to have sensitivity, will have sensitivity, the level of the percentage at scales corresponding 0.1 inverse megaparsec, which is corresponding, so this stretch factor gives enhancement for the 10 or 20 there. So, again, if you're lucky enough, if this factor is reasonably high, so you need some factor for the 10. So you may see it with galaxy surveys. But eventually, so if 21 centimeter measurements will fly, then they will be able to probe scales from 10 to minus 2 inverse megaparsec, 10 up to 1 kiloparsec. So that would correspond. So this is this mass range I'm showing here. This is up to 10 to 18 electron volt. And that, okay, if it will work, that will really be very precise measurement because cosmic coherence limitation there is tiny. So just to compare, from potentially from this measurement, you can get for the 10 to 16 numbers as opposed to 10 to 8 or something for CMB. So in principle, in this whole mass range, you can measure the power spectrum, and you can see really many of these features. So that's, for instance, really a characteristic difference of what I'm talking about from just having free streaming neutrinos. You're not expecting to see many free streaming neutrinos. So here you have the multitude of these things is really the prediction of this, so what you naturally expect. And actually, coming back to these things we heard about yesterday, these measure issues. So one can ask different interesting questions now, because we're not measuring one number here. So it's really making, so that's the usual problem with measures, that you're predicting one number. Here there are many quantities which are quite similar.
What does the measure have to do with how many numbers you predict?
No, for instance, so there are this anthropic region. So you may see many steps, which are some of them in non-anthropic region, some of them in anthropic region. Now you may ask, what is the probability distribution for the sizes of the steps? What are the probability distribution for initial axion misalignment angle? For instance, there can be several axions in the anthropic region. So do you expect it will be dominated by one, or it will be homogeneously distributed? So here you really measure several quantities of the same nature.
And that's great, but I mean, you're free to consider predicting multiple variables. I mean, the scan various observables at the same time and try to predict.
Yeah, I agree, but
it's been done by many collaborators.
No, I agree. No, but here it's almost one and the same observable. It's really like measuring one wave function many times. So yeah, so in that sense, yeah, of course. But to some extent, this is cleaner situation, I think. So what else should I say at this point?
This is going to be the most sensitive thing to look for, these features in the dark matter power spectrum in this mass range?
Yeah. No, but again, if 21 centimeter will fly, that's very sensitive. Very sensitive. Yeah. Okay, so probably that's it for this mass range. Now let me come now to the even higher masses, which are actually originally you could care most about, because now I'm approaching QCD axion mass range. And there is really quite surprising story. So now I'll be talking about masses. So I have CMB. Here there is CDM power spectrum. Now, talking about masses, there is probably some overlap with this range, so it's from 10 to minus around 21, 22 electron volt up to 10 to minus 9 electron volt. So I'm talking really here, there are really QCD axions with God scale effects. So what happens here? We know there are many black holes in the universe. Basically, it's believed that every galaxy has a black hole in its center, and there are many stellar-sized black holes. And recently, people started doing observations, measurements not only of the mass of black holes, but also of the angular momentum of these black holes. And the way it's done, so there is accretion which goes into black hole, and the size of the closest stable orbit is rather sensitive to the angular momentum. It varies by a factor of 6 if you go from Schwarzschild to maximally rotating Kerr metric. So that's how the way that's the way people trying to measure spin, and that's something which is actually being done now. And there are several black holes in the mass range 10 to 20 solar masses with rather high spins. So for my purposes, the most interesting one will be with 10 solar masses with this mass spin to mass ratio of 0.9. There's some phone number associated with LMC X1 associated to this black hole. And also, again, there are galactic black holes, and at the moment there is one with mass around 10 to 6 solar masses. Again, it was there are claims that they see high A, even higher than 0.9. There is some evidence for spins higher than that. And I should say, apparently, there is some uncertainty in all this because there is some accretion disk modeling coming into it, but it's going to be improved. And again, eventually, if there will be gravitational wave experiments, they would be able to do it really much in much cleaner and precise way. Now, what this whole thing has to do with axions? So let me remind you that if you have a rotating black hole, there is the region which is called ergosphere, where from the point of view of asymptotic observer, you have negative energies there because, I mean, the light cones are bended so much in the azimuthal direction that you cannot stay without rotating in that region, and that corresponds to having negative energy from the point of view of asymptotic observer. So that gives rise to possibility of Penrose process, namely particle can come in, then you can throw some garbage into the black hole and come out, and this garbage can carry negative energy from point of view of asymptotic observer. So this is a way to extract energy from the black hole. And of course, the same thing can happen not only for particle, can also happen for field. So if you have incoming wave on the black hole for certain frequency range and certain angular momentum number, the result of scattering of the from the black hole gets amplified. So it increases its energy. Now,
presumably this moves the black hole away from externality.
Yeah, of course, the result of this process is that you extract spin from the black hole, so black hole spins down. Yes.
Okay, but the time scale is long for that.
Well, so far I didn't say it was just one such event. Now I'm coming to time scale. So now imagine that you can do it with photons. You can extract black hole energy with photons, but you can do it once. But now you can imagine doing the following, which was suggested by Prestikolsky many years ago. You can surround black hole by mirror. Now, what happens if you have photon inside this mirror? It will go to the black hole. If there is a wave packet, so there is some frequency which gets amplified, they bounce to infinity, but then they get reflected from the mirror, and they experience consequent amplification during the scattering. So this goes.
For the Penrose process, you have to throw the thing in just the right way, right? It has to
Yeah, but for the wave, there is some condition. There is, so frequency of the incoming wave should be larger than, so this is frequency, this is azimuthal number, and this is the angular momentum of the horizon. So for frequencies in this range...
It doesn't matter which way it's coming from. I mean, like, if it's going in at the poles, presumably, it's not going to, it's just going to feed the black hole.
No, but that's all encoded in this M number. So in the
if you shoot it, if you try to do it with a BB gun, I mean, you gotta you know, aim very accurately.
Yeah, but no, but that's the advantage of having a field, because field has
all of
frequencies.
Them
yeah.
So there is M is azimuthal number.
So it's the angular momentum.
Yeah, it's angular momentum. So for frequency in this range, waves with this M and omega, they get necessarily get amplified. So that's what's good about having waves as opposed to particles. You don't need to care about
the other. You have to worry about what the mirror does to this condition, like when the photon bounces in the mirror.
No, not I mean, well,
if you just had a mirror.
Yeah, of course, if it's not spherical, it will change.
But if a field has a mass automatically works as a.
No, okay, I'm coming to that, yeah. But so far, so if you have a spherical mirror, then it will amplify things. Of course, if it's non spherical, it gets somewhat more complicated, but kind of clear, because field has all wavelengths, and some of them gets amplified here, and then they bounce back. So details of how the mirror looks, it affects the efficiency of this process.
So the plan was to build a big mirror? Was it?
No, the plan, so as Nemanja was saying, so nature may provide such a mirror.
Okay.
Namely, if you have a massive particle,
yeah,
then mass acts as a mirror. Basically, because you have a photon which escapes from the black hole, it redshifts, it goes away. But if you have a massive particle, it gets back. Or another way of saying that, you can imagine putting a wave packet and just putting it on the stable Keplerian orbit around this black hole. But again, because it's not a particle, it's a wave, there will be always the tail of this wave packet which would go to ergosphere and get amplified there. So if you have a massive particle, so the bottom line is, if you have a massive particle in the Kerr background, then Kerr metric becomes unstable. There is exponential classical instability due to this effect. And
this is what Pressetukovsky found?
No, that was found in two papers. One of them is really good, by Zuras and Erdley of 1980, and paper by Dietwiller 1975, and these papers, they have like one citation per year since that, and nobody says that you can apply this axioms. So what happens, so it's quite clear now what happens, so there is this instability, which depends, so of course, so the size of the mirror in this case is roughly the inverse axion mass, so the efficiency of this effect depends on the mass. So it's maximally efficient when MRS, something of order 1/2. So at this parameter range, it's rather an efficient process. So the characteristic time scale for growth is 10 to 7 Schwarzschild radii, even at this optimal mass. But still, if you're talking about stellar mass black hole, so this is a tony scale. Universe is very long-lived, so 10 to 7 times 1 kilometer is nothing compared to the age of the universe. So as a result, you don't need really to be very fine-tuned to the Schwarzschild radius to have an effect. So roughly, observing a black hole with A of order 0.9, it removes about a couple of 2 to 3 orders of magnitude in axion parameter space, in the mass range of axions. So, for instance, from just, if we believe that interpretation of this guy's spinning black hole with the spin is right, that puts a bound on the FA of the QCD axion at the level less than 6, 10 to 16 GV, which is already...
Sorry, just because otherwise the black hole could not have been spun up to that. I mean,
but what happens, if it were speed up, then this is the mechanism for spin down of black hole. So what happens, it would create axion cloud around itself, which sucks spin out of the black hole till the moment when it becomes rotating slowly. And the fact that we see...
It couldn't keep the
spin. Yeah, yeah. And the fact that we see this black hole... Yeah.
So, I just wanted to ask about back reactions. So if these systems are so strongly coupled, is it really clear that the thing doesn't somehow...
Well, this is linear...
It's spinning up the axion, right?
No, this is linear effect. This is linear instability. And actually, you never get... So at most, if you're doing this Penrose process, for maximum rotating a black hole, if you do everything adiabatically, so the most you can get is about 20% of black hole mass in this axion cloud. So it's not terribly... So, yeah, at some point it can become nonlinear. And it's interesting question what happens then. So there are two possibilities. Either you will have this stable system of black hole which is non-spinning and you have this axion cloud rotating around it. Or maybe the moment there's some critical value when this whole system destabilizes accretion disk and there will be some burst of... But this is non-linear question. I don't know what happens when the system goes non-linear. So, but there is linear stage of the effect, which is...
What does that do to the... How much do you know about whether that this is then allowed? Are you saying that despite uncertainties of what happens there, this black hole still robustly rules out some range of axion masses?
Yeah.
And why doesn't it depend on this? I haven't gotten your point. Why it doesn't depend on all this complicated stuff?
No, because just on the linear growth stage, you keep spinning down it. Afterwards, it can explode the whole thing.
By the time you get to the non-linear regime, you're already way below this angular momentum.
Yeah, because actually the spin, this instability rate is very sensitive to angular momentum. So if your A is something around 0.5, it gets very, very slow. But even irrespectively of what happens at the non-linear stage, so it's either would be some explosion, or you will have just cloud rotating around. Still, you suck black.
The M here is the mass of your axion, right?
Yeah.
And what do you say about the frequency? Given M.
No, sorry. This is M. These are two different. This was mu. This is M. So for the frequency for optimal. For the most unstable level, is something like 0.98 of mu. It's smaller than the mass because it is a bound state. So it's of order the mass, the frequency.
What is mu?
Mu is the mass of the axion, just because there is also m here.
What is m?
M is azimuthal number.
Spin.
Angular momentum of the wave.
Angular momentum of the wave. Well, because for massive fields, you can have...
Yeah, but is there a relation? Apart from the fact that they are both massive fields...
No, just that the moment field has a mass, you can have stable Eulerian orbits around black hole. So this is another way of saying that mass acts as a mirror.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I guess...
No, but there is a very...
That last step. It's another way of saying that the mass acts...
No, because photon doesn't... Cannot go around black hole on a stable... No, mirror is formal, more technical
way.
You can look at the potential. So you study perturbation of black hole. There is some effective potential when you go to tortoise coordinates, and you find it has roughly this form. So this centrifugal barrier, there is this horizon is here, so ergosphere is here, and then if there is a mass, so it creates. But some potential wave well here. So there are bound states which live here. So bound state of the axion, which really correspond just to clumps of the axion rotating.
I mean, you might probably imagine something like, a very relativistic Mercury zipping around and elongating orbits around the sun and precessing like crazy because of the fact that, the particle is very relativistic in these last stable orbits around the spinning black hole. And so the whole system is sort of just zipping, 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 and growing, 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 growing.
Yeah. So you have a wave packet living here, and
This is the standard. This is the standard GR potential for scalar perturbation in the Kerr matrix. The radial part. If you do when you do separation of variables, you look at the radial potential. And what you find is that mass of the axion, what it does for you, it lifts potential at infinity. It goes to mu squared. So it creates a potential way well here around black hole, which is just reflection of the fact that you may have stable Keplerian orbits.
My question is, if you extract a lot of angular momentum out of the black hole, extracting a lot of energy, and even in the innermost stable circular orbit, the binding energy per unit mass is it's not huge. I'm wondering, would that blow the sphere away? It just seems, you can draw that mirror, but it's
No, you mean that the moment this there is a moment when this whole system becomes nonlinear. So far, I'm talking about linear perturbation theory. As soon as scalar mass is small compared to the black hole, it's all just linearized perturbation. Well, it can get to 20% or something. Maybe at that point it goes away, but then the process will repeat again. It's exponential classical instability which is there. Yeah, so there's a potentially interesting uncertainty what really happens when this thing becomes nonlinear. You may expect to see like burst-like events. Say,
if I just have a spinning black hole with this extra field, there's a linear instability.
So
you didn't even tell me anything about the mirror.
No, absolutely no. They just want to explain where it's coming from because it sounds amazing because you had this huge stable object, and now you add the standard model particle, which doesn't interact with anything. It's just gravitationally coupled, and it makes the object unstable. But at the technical level, all what you do, you take Kerr metric, you study small perturbations of the scalar field, and you find there is an unstable muon.
How does John with cosmic no air theorem? Usually, the cosmic no air theorem, you have perturbations of a Kerr black hole.
No, what you find usually, there are these quasi-normal modes which describe exactly how hair disappears. They have imaginary parts which are negative and characterize what time it takes for perturbation to dissipate. What happens here is that for massive field, for some of these modes becomes truly bound state and the imaginary part changes sign. It becomes positive rather than negative. So it's really, rather than dissipating this perturbation, rather than being dissipated, they just grow by Penrose process.
And if you like, it drives fine because it just tells you that one of the classical hairs suddenly actually itself becomes unstable.
So what precisely is required, what are the requirements of the field in order to have this instability?
Well, it's technically always present, but it's efficient and the rate depends on the mass. So it's maximal for mass of order the size of the black hole. And it rapidly goes down when you detune the mass.
But the Lagrangian that you use is just a Lagrangian for a massive.
Yeah, just pre-scalar field, pre-massless scalar field in the
massive
scalar field in the Kerr background. Yeah.
So this is there for any mass.
Yeah.
In principle, it's there for any mass. The question is the rate. But the point is that even the highest rate you can get is pretty low on the black hole time scale. So that tells you that this is well under control. So long compared to any dynamical scale for black hole, 10 to 7 RS. But the point is that the universe is very long-lived. So for stellar-sized black hole, 10 to 7 kilometers, that's nothing. So you can allow yourself to be well away, for instance, from this optimal mass, and still this gives a bound.
Can you explain again this Dublin inequality for dummies? I mean, I just still don't get it. M is a quantum number.
Yeah, so this is the fine. I'm taking just incoming wave, transfer wave in the form E I omega t plus I m phi f of r and theta.
What is omega?
Omega is a frequency.
No, the big one on the right.
A black hole.
The horizon, the null vector which goes, which tangent to horizon is dt plus omega. So it's roughly angular momentum of the angular velocity of the black hole horizon. I don't know what.
And so if I have some axion and it has some mass mu,
No, it's, so this is completely independent of the mass. If you have any field...
That's fine.
Yeah.
So now I'm trying to understand what I'm supposed to think of as being little omega when I have an axion.
Yeah. So then what you...
Is it, you imagine that I've excited lots of different frequencies?
Yeah.
Some that are going to satisfy this and others that aren't.
Yeah, what you look for the spectrum of axion excitation, the curve background, and you find that there is some continuous spectrum corresponding to unbound states. Then there are some bound modes, and what you find is that there are frequencies, let me call omega star, which are complex and which has real part, which is in this range, and they have positive imaginary part, which corresponds to the fact that these modes are actually, and these are truly bound states, so these are excitations which go exponentially at infinity. So
what I'm trying to understand is whether there are also non, super radiance type effects.
Yes, there
are, which would act in the opposite direction. So are there also parts of the axion field that sort of fall into the black hole in the usual way?
Yeah, of course. There are excitations,
so
there are stable excitations of axion.
Does that take into account? I mean, do you take that into account here? In other words, couldn't that compensate for the loss of action?
This is a linear theory. You can't convert in the linear theory the super radiant modes and the non super radiant modes don't talk to each other.
So there are stable modes and there are unstable modes. So stable modes get sucked in the black hole, but the point is that unstable modes grow exponentially. And so it's like, I mean, if you put pen like this, there will be some mode which is its instability. And
so the way
that will
to think of this is that the part of the action field that can spin up the black hole is finished. And
Yeah. It gets, it dissipates, as usual harem and it gets dissipated. Yeah.
So the final state is just some axion radiation going out of infinity and a non-spinning black hole. You have to make sure that the entropy of that final black hole is greater than the initial state. So it better be that however much.
No, of course it follows.
That's the famous application of the area theorem.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly.
This is
right.
Penrose process satisfies second law of thermodynamics. But it is due to Penrose process. It's nothing more than Penrose.
You don't know what the final state is. All you know is that the back reaction gets large and then something happens.
Yeah.
Can you get some interesting constraint on, like, for example, is it consistent that all the angular is carried away by axioms?
Yeah, because, for instance, just to start with, you create them all in one state. You increase black hole entropy.
This is a local process, right? It doesn't matter what it's doing, the carrying away of the
Yeah. Actually, the way to derive this instability, one way to derive that there is instability in this mass range is exactly imposing that there should be second law of thermodynamics, and it forces you that there is negative energy flux from black hole in this mass range.
The trick is
just whether you can say anything interesting about the final state. For example, one possible final state is that there's some sort of bound state where there's an axion.
Yeah, so in this situation, this bound state would have zero entropy, because it's just Bose-Einstein condensate of the scalar particles in one and the same quantum state. But the area of the black hole grew during this Penrose process. So I don't think you can say anything.
Does this instability exist with ordinary matter?
Ordinary,
you
mean?
An accretion disk around the black hole.
I think so, from this physical picture. All what you need, so still there is ergosphere. You're still amplifying energy there, and still mass acts there.
Well, could there be some sort of back and forth where, this happens, and then
you can
as a result, you have more
B.
ordinary matter falling in and
the
black hole up?
Yeah, the thing I'm asking is that there are field equations for GR,
yeah,
for the scalar field, and when you do this calculation that shows that there's less instability, there's nothing else.
Yeah.
But if you have matter of accretion...
No, that's true, but first of all, they're not really that much of matter, because this bound state is localized around RS, at a few RS around black hole. So it's really close to the black hole. There is accretion disk, but it looks like a small perturbation. It's not. I agree that it's...
Are you saying that the time scale is much larger for the matter to call black back in and spin that black hole?
That's how we got this limit. So basically you compare this time scale, it should be faster than, say, accretion rate with which you accrete angular momentum on the black hole. So definitely, this instability rate is too slow, then you don't get a bound. So that's how you get
the bound on the axial mass. It should be too far away. This process should be faster than accretion. Yeah, absolutely.
And there are always modes with frequencies in that special range for any mass.
Yeah, and just Kerber grounded, yeah.
Just understand one last thing. These axions, once they have taken away a lot of angular momentum, they fly away or they keep orbiting there?
In the linear regime, they keep orbiting there. They just this clump grows.
I mean, the angular momentum of the whole system is still all there.
Yeah.
How do we measure that?
But I mean, it's not. But remember, because you measure angular momentum by looking at the closest stable orbit, and that depends on the black hole momentum. Now you have some stuff rotating around, but
you don't know that because this thing will build up to some level and then you don't know what happens after that. It could be that there's a solution in which there's a large amount of angular in the axial field.
Yeah.
No,
I agree. In principle, yeah, really one should do the full nonlinear calculation of this. And really, to include this effect in the way people model accretion disks, etc. So that's something beyond my abilities at the moment. But
things are not very good, right? Because the observations are...
No, and also, yeah, this... So at the moment, probably it's more like to think... indicative and tells you what kind of precision you can eventually... get, but I think it would be too strong to say really this is excluded now. I think it's strong indication for that, but it's more tells you about the range of masses which you can probe with these kind of things, which makes it even more interesting for me. So eventually, if you observe, say, couple solar mass black holes with A of order one, that this value will be sensitive to FA of order 5. 10 to 15 dB. So it goes well below gut scale. So, and definitely it's something which should be done accurately, taken, doing proper modeling of accretion disk, taken into account this effect. Absolutely, and it's important to understand what this nonlinear stage does for you. Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's a better way of putting it. It's more like the way to probe axions, not that they're excluded right now.
Would this put constraints on, for instance, neutrinos or anything else in the same mass range?
No, not for fermions, because it's laser, so you populate one and the same level due to this. But black hole acts as inversely populated system for you, and it populates some particular level outside. So no, not for fermions. But it's hard to get bosons with that small mass. The nice thing about axion is Goldstone boson, so it's. But in principle, if you have a model with spin 10 particles in that mass range, that calculation I think hasn't been done. So it depends. The rate, for instance, depends on the spin, but you expect it. Yeah.
So, but this, I mean, the problem for the axion really is something that you have a spherical resonator with a central force, and then internally a boundary that acts like an anti-absorber, if you want.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really, like, I mean, because then you can solve, quantum mechanics gives you that these imaginary wave numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting. I wonder whether we can try this in a laboratory. Like, I know that you can take very slow neutrons, store them above a glass plate, so that the gravity bound puts them into bound states, quantum states, and if the glass plate is rough or absorbing, then they get eaten. But now whether there could be a way to make effectively an anti-absorber, so you build up the state.
I think that's how laser works, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, but with something like massive particles, that for low densities, you don't care about the spin.
Yeah.
So it's an
azer?
Huh?
Okay, so I should probably conclude. To summarize, first, I think taking seriously strong CP problem plus properties of axion and string theory leads to rather predictive and unconventional scenario for upcoming cosmological experiments. And just to conclude, so Yeah, there is one more. I'm using thought which one could have. So imagine you really, first of all, there are opportunities really like measuring, doing this wave function thing, so measuring many quantities of similar kind. But so imagine you really found in the sky evidence for many light scalar fields with mass range from Hubble to some higher scale. Then you may think that maybe what scans cosmological constant for you, the part of the scanning of cosmological constant for you, is done by just these axion scalar fields. So usually in Raphael's picture with Joe, the cosmological constant scanning done at high energies, at scale scales. You have many fluxes, so roughly with the field theory model for that is that you have many scalar fields with potential all say, God scale, so some heavy scale, and you have 100 of that. But you can do something which you may call Wilsonian scanning. So instead of doing that, you have fields with these scales, say, exponentially distributed over energy range. That's what happens for axions. And then, so roughly at each energy range, there is axion which takes care of canceling vacuum energy at that scale. Of course, there is no particular motivation for this extreme picture, for neither of those. So general condition for successful scanning is that above each energy, so the number of fields above this energy should be larger than log of E over M Planck, something like that. So this should be enough scalar fields at all scales, at above each scale to allow successful scanning. So there are fluxes in string theory, they could do scanning for you, but also these axions in principle.
Well, everything will do scanning, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
In other words, the same cycles that you.
Yeah,
so
but.
Not just because of the contribution of the flux to the CC, but just because of the contribution of every crappy field.
Yeah, but I think if you really see many of these scalar fields, I think that's the closest you can get to really finding the guys who do. So I think you really start thinking that maybe they do scanning. And they come from the same sources as these fluxes. They also. It just cycles. Cycles give rise both to axions and to these form fields. Okay, I'll stop here.
We started late, and you know, I think Sergey has been grilled a lot, and I'm sure people will continue over the lunch break. But let's take a very short break and then continue with Alex Westphal, who's going to tell us about monodal manipulation.